58% of Republicans in America say that colleges have a negative impact on the direction of the country. That's 20% more than felt that way 2 years ago, according to an annual survey conducted by the Pew Research Center. And it's in stark contrast to Democrats. Nearly three-quarters of them hold a positive view of higher ed institutions. We wondered when college became a partisan issue, so we rang up Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly. They are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Men, welcome back. An important distinction here as we begin, we're talking about the institutions of colleges and universities, not the concept of education itself. Nathan, you first. How long has higher education been a partisan issue?
Well, it's important to keep in mind that colleges are older than the country itself, right? That they're older than any business, and they have been fraught with conflicts of various kinds. You have gentlemen scholars and kind of hardcore intellectuals. You have obviously the conflicts that arose around the incorporation of women and people of color in the 19th century, even whether or not one would study classics or vocations became a site of, you know, bitter contests. And that, to really appreciate where we are with the narrative and the headlines now, you have to understand that conflict is built into the enterprise of higher education. But I think it's also important to bear in mind that what we're seeing is part of what is really a 20th century story, insofar as most people didn't need college to enter the middle class or didn't believe they needed college to enter the middle class. And so you're going to get fresh conflicts and really, you know, stark divides around what it simply means to be a member of the middle class in America, revolving around colleges and universities.
Ed, how do you see it?
Yeah, well, that's right. And you think there's all these different layers of conflict and of continuity and change. I think the real origins of all this lie after World War II, when American higher education was transformed by the GI Bill, and then 15, 20 years later by the integration of women who now account for the majority of college students, which is a very rapid change, and by the incorporation of people from all different kinds of ethnic backgrounds, financial aid. So what you're seeing is a kind of a partisan overlay over a big cultural divide over a fundamental economic and demographic transition. So it's got as many elements as you can imagine going on.
Could you describe for those who are too young to remember what the GI Bill was all about and what it did, in other words, help create the middle class and more?
So the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, which we call the GI Bill, you know, radically expanded the government's support of people trying to enter higher education. And some 2.2 million men entered universities across the country in an effort to basically prepare them for what was emerging as the white-collar economy of the mid-20th century. And so when we think about the fact that education and even a college education now is almost considered to be a default, you know, requirement or credential, that was not the case in the early part of the 20th century, and only really became so as universities began to welcome in these millions of men. And obviously then, you know, women's colleges, which existed before, also began to expand to deal with the increasing demand.
And so the government was paying the bill for that, paying the tuition bill, meaning. And the result of that was what?
There are many results from that, because not only was the government paying the tuition bill, but enormous amounts of money were flooding into colleges and universities for R&D, for science, and
That's
for
right.
business development, right? I mean, this is where the internet comes from. and so you find that there's a kind of a golden age of that's defined by the growth of the huge universities that we know today really take off in the 50s and 60s, in which you not only have a broadened student body, but you also have all this revenue flowing in. And that's what people look back on and imagine is what this is all supposed to be like. But it was only that way for a relatively short time.
And then what happened?
Right.
Well, as early as the 70s, you started finding that there's, you know, the labor market starts contracting, state support for colleges and universities declines. The absolute amount of money going into higher education is not declining, but as a proportion, it's been a steady decline since the golden age of the 60s and 70s.
And the baby boom that came out of the kind of war demobilization of the 1940s basically created huge spikes in the numbers of high schoolers by the time you got to the late 60s and early 70s, right? So states like New York or California that in that period of the 60s and 70s had really robust public funding simply couldn't afford to pay for all the kids who were seeking, you know, free or near free college tuition. And so then again creates a whole host of, you know, dilemmas and political fault lines. And we famously know about the social movements of the 1960s being about government spending on university campuses. So all of this creates a really powerful kind of narrative and really a flashpoint in the 60s that really helps to politicize what we now consider to be the partisan debates in higher education going forward.
When we talk about the partisan debates now, I mean, you've been taking it back incrementally through the period just after World War II. What about the way back? Was higher education such a partisan issue in the very beginning? I mean, say around the 1600s in America?
Well, it's partisan between Protestant denominations, you know. Who's going to control these colleges? One reason there are so many colleges is that every denomination felt that it had to have its own in
right.
order to teach its children the right version. And then, of course, you have all the – every kind of religious faith creates its own colleges and universities. So – in many ways, that partisan divide would have was the engine behind one reason we have 4,000 colleges and universities now. What you're, of course, talking about with partisan divide is the Democrats and Republicans. You would have found for a long time it was good business for everybody to build this infrastructure of higher education.
That's right. I mean, and as much as we focus on partisanship, there's a way in which that emphasis really does conceal deeper fault lines and deeper divides, right? I mean, even as we talk about the kind of creation of the middle class in the mid part of the 20th century, we have to bear in mind that our current understanding of higher education is really framed by a number of different economic factors. And one of them has to be understood as the flatlining of wages in America, really over the last 50 years. I mean, you know, you can find a number of different ways to kind of look at this. But for me, one of the most compelling numbers is $1.49. That's $1.49, which is the amount in real wages that have, you know, working people have had as an increase over the last 50 years. So with all the expectation that one is supposed to go to college, that one is supposed to work a decent white collar job, you know, you're not seeing wages increase in any amount that is commensurate with the kind of investment that college currently represents for most working families.
So the more colleges and universities got tied up in the general economics of the country and people's pocketbooks, the more controversial they became. For you both as university professors, what do you think when you hear that some 58% of Republicans in America don't think higher education, according to this poll anyway, don't think that higher education serves the best interest of the country?
Yeah, so I am a university professor. I'm also a former dean and a former president. So I've seen what this looks like up close. And what I can tell you is that people may say this in a poll, but I don't find any shortage of Democrats or Republicans who want their kids to go to the very best college that they can. So there's a disconnect between the rhetoric and reality on this front.
I think it's also, you know, important to keep in mind that, you know, the spike that we're seeing in people on the right being suspicious of higher education has a strange correlation with, you know, our election of the professor in chief in terms of Barack Obama, right? There was a way in which he was cast as being out of touch and elite, you know, almost by default, disconnected from middle America as a former law school professor. There are obviously, you know, other kinds of questions around whether or not universities are really the kinds of hiding places of radicals of various kinds that, again, lead to a certain kind of, you know, suspicion on the part of those who are on the right about higher education. But the other thing, too, is that, you know, even when you talk about some of the more elite institutions, the vast majority of Americans go to our public institutions in this country. You know, they're parts of various state systems in Florida and Texas and elsewhere. And there really is, I think, an important effort on the part of many people to really just understand that these institutions have to be responsive to the needs of everyday folk, whether you're talking about keeping tuition costs low, whether you're talking about the ways in which, you know, tuition is, you know, climbing in many of these places relative to the expenses of these educational systems. And, you know, at a less kind of, you know, lofty level, there are people who are really concerned with really basic things like open carry laws that you see, you know, being put forward in states like Kansas or in Texas and so forth. And I think in each one of these moments, you know, it's an affirmation of what Ed said earlier, which is that, you know, politics is always going to be involved in higher education. It has long been a place where, you know, you look to institutions like universities to kind of set the next generation of political things in order. And I guess I would simply just say that even if we have a partisan fault line of one kind or another, that our success as a society will really depend on our ability to deal with those deepest fault lines, again, the economic ones and the ones that really are, you know, invisible beyond some of the chatter.
Nice to talk to you both. Nathan Connolly and Ed Ayers, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa.